turn that on for you. Okay.
Real good. I'm wired for sound. My name is Arbutus O'Neill, and it is by the grace of God that I belong to the Al-Anon family groups.
Hi, Arbutus.
Hi, Arbutus.
I am powerless over people, places, and things. And because of the program, I can make this admission without feeling guilty. My life continues to be unmanageable when I fail to practice the principles of a program that was given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to believe that the families of the early members of AA were convinced by the miracle of sobriety that this program would work for everyone. And it was out of this conviction that the Al-Anon family groups grew to reach all over the world and have shown astounding results. We subscribe to the concept that alcoholism is a family illness. And then we get so carried away telling people how sick we got that we forget to say, we have a program for family recovery. Ours is a fellowship that shares. But please, let us share our recovery, not our sickness. And that's what these weekends are all about. These gatherings that we call conventions, roundups, jamborees, whatever. Here we have a showcase of recovery. We listen to the speakers. Sometimes we participate in the workshops. We support the members of AA and Alateen. And we see whole families getting well while they're having a wonderful time. And I'm very, very happy to be a part of your celebration. It's been a long time since I've been in Iowa. I was trying so hard to remember your first delegate. I remembered that her name was Audrey, but I could not remember her first name and what her surname was. But I did remember finally, or someone reminded me, it was Audrey Stevens. And she was from, was it Waterloo? Is that a name of a, I think so. Very grateful. Do we have some alcoholics this afternoon? Yeah. Hey, that looks good. I think it's so silly for me to talk to Al-Anon people because most of them know more about the program than I do. I'm called a long-timer in the Al-Anon family groups, and this isn't very important until you get to be a long-timer. And I once thought that alcoholism was a product of my generation. But this isn't true. Alcoholism is an insidious, progressive disease that prompts the unthinking to make jokes about drunks, but it can leave a family homeless and penniless. Alcoholism is a public cancer that can turn a man or a woman against themselves. Alcoholism is a blight on the history of mankind. The Bible warns against it. Shakespeare diagnosed it. Tennessee Williams built a prize-winning play around it, but no one, as far as I've been able to learn, seemed to be able to do anything about alcoholism until the advent of AA. Priests and ministers were baffled at their inability to solve the problem that drinkers caused. They preached to alcoholics, they prayed over you, they had you to sign pledges, and when these things fail, they damned your soul to hell. Men of science wanted to find a pill or wanted to find a cure for alcoholism. They wanted to find a pill or a vaccine that would stop compulsive drinking. And failing to do this, they said to the medical students, don't waste your time on these people. They're hopeless. Preachment failed, and there was no cure. So there was only one other thing they knew to do with alcoholics. You must be punished. So, we locked you up in jail. The more you drank, the longer we kept you in jail. The longer we kept you in jail, the more you drank when you were released. It became a vicious cycle. We tried to change the body chemistry of sick people with punishment. And society allowed this to happen. Nay, we insisted on it to our everlasting shame. But there was one group of people who never gave up on the alcoholic. These were the families of alcoholics, the people who loved you. We took jobs to feed the children that you were too sick to be responsible for. We doctored your hangovers. Some of us bought your liquor. We picked up your hot checks, bailed you out of jail. We pled with judges. We said, John's a good man when he's sober. And to repeat this ridiculous paradox, we gave you hell every time you got drunk. Every time you got drunk. And people couldn't understand the families of alcoholics. They just could not understand us. They could understand the alcoholic. When you walked off your jobs and wrecked your cars and wore lampshades on your head at parties, they could understand you because you had been drinking. But they couldn't understand us. They could not understand why we continued to love and care for the alcoholic. They didn't seem to understand that alcoholics are not always drunk. And I go on record of saying that alcoholics are the most charming people in the world when they are sober. There were some people, of course, that thought we were endowed with some special quality that made us better than other people. They were the ones that gave us the nice shiny halos to wear. They almost killed us with pity. We don't need pity, we need understanding. These people, I put my halo on every morning when I put on my lipstick. And my halo had a name. It was called self-righteousness. Did you ever notice that word doesn't taste good? It doesn't. Self-righteousness. Other people, of course, thought we were plain fools to live under such circumstances. My mother came in this group. Mother used to say, God looks after fools and drunks, and that takes care of our abuse and bill. And Mother was right. God did look after us when we didn't have sense enough to look after ourselves. And then time went by, as it always does, and the professionals got interested in the families of alcoholics. They conducted surveys and headed up research projects. I can remember one that took place, I think it was under the auspices of a National Council on Alcoholism in the early 60s. They wanted to learn what kind of women marry alcoholics. It was a total waste of time and government money, and I could have told them right off that women do not marry alcoholics. Women marry men they love, and some of them are alcoholics. Nothing to it. But I got a little disgusted with all of these research projects, and so I decided I'd do some research on my own. And I learned that Alexander the Great was an alcoholic. He'd conquered the whole known civilized world when he was 33 years old. And he wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. But he couldn't conquer his desire to drink. And he died drunk. Stephen Foster was an alcoholic. He gave the world its most beautiful folk music. But he was a compulsive drinker. It seemed to come on him like a sickness, his wife once said. And so it does. Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. He could weave the magic of children's stories, and he all but destroyed himself with the magic that he found in the bottle. It could have been a fifth of gin or a quart of bourbon. And he describes the personality change of the alcoholic in the story Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I watched that personality change right in my own living room, just like a lot of you did. You saw the man you love turn into a babbling idiot, into a degenerate animal, into a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. History said little about the families of these men and others like them, but I believe that I know the fear and the loneliness that Jeannie knew when she waited for her husband to come home from a spree. And I believe I know the homesickness that Fanny Stevenson knew when she left her home in California to go to a South Sea island with her husband. Robert Louis Stevenson had a dual problem. He also had tuberculosis. And I believe I know the joy that they knew when he did regain his health. And I believe I know the serenity that they knew when he found sobriety. I hope you enjoyed your history lesson. I used to try to explain why I do these things, and I told you that I give you a history lesson because I can't tell jokes. I always forget the punchline. But a few years back, I was invited to come up into Illinois to speak at a conference up there, and a pretty little lady came to the airport to pick me up. And she told me that she was a member of AA and that she had asked the Al-Anon committee permission to pick me up and drive me to the convention center because she wanted to talk to me. And after we got out on the highway on our way to the conference center, she explained. She said when her drinking became a problem, she absolutely could not admit she was an alcoholic. She'd never lost a job. She'd never been kicked out of school. She'd never even got a parking ticket. There was no way that that woman could be an alcoholic. And she went to some AA meetings, and good Lord of mercy, she didn't want to be mixed up with that kind of people. But then she heard one of those tapes. Those tapes have caused me an awful lot of trouble. She heard one of those tapes when I said that Alexander the Great was an alcoholic, and she thought that was pretty good company, and she hasn't had a drink since. Now I give you a history lesson to try to explain to you the change of attitude that has happened in the years since AA came into being. It's possible now to get an alcoholic in the hospital with a simple diagnosis of alcoholism. But when my Bill got into trouble with his drinking, you could not get an alcoholic in the hospital, not unless the doctor falsified his diagnosis. Couldn't do it. Priests and ministers now that feel that alcoholics are God's children too, and they send them to treatment so they can get well. And they send their families to us so they can get well too. county judges send alcoholics to treatment or to AA groups instead of sending them to jail. And we have fabulous rehabilitation programs in our federal penitentiaries under the auspices of AA. Magazines and newspapers write articles on alcoholism. Marty Mann did a tremendous job educating the public that alcoholism indeed is a sickness, and that alcoholics are sick people who need help, and that they deserve help. It's almost impossible anymore to pick up a magazine or a newspaper and not find an article on alcoholism. It seems to me that it has become the in thing to have an alcoholic in your family. Now, if you don't have one, I suggest that you borrow one. They're the handiest things you can have. They are as handy as a pocket on the shirt. Anything that goes wrong, it's their fault. When I came here, I came into this outfit before we had an outfit. When I came here, we had 50 groups in the whole world. Seven of them were in the state of Texas. 50 groups in the whole world. We didn't have a program to live by. And worse than that, we didn't have a purpose to live for. All we had in those very early days was the growing awareness of a great need for help and the dubious permission of some people who were very new in AA to come to their meeting places while they had a meeting. And that's what we did. We met in wide little hallways and dirty little kitchens, anywhere we could put a few chairs. And we sat together and we talked. Now, you know very well what we talked about. It was kind of a morbid competition to determine which one of us lived with the sorriest man. And I wasn't comfortable in those meetings because I didn't live with the sorry man. I lived with a fine young man who drank too much. We didn't have any literature. Not one single piece of literature did we have. We didn't have 12 or 14 hardback books, each contradicting the other. We didn't have enough pamphlets to paper this auditorium. We didn't have any literature at all. Al-Anon is a kissing cousin to invention. They were both born of necessity. And the dear people who put the life-changing program of Alcoholics Anonymous together knew that in time, the families of alcoholics would become aware of this need for help. And so when they wrote the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, they made provisions for us, because they included in that book two chapters for the families of alcoholics. One of them, of course, is entitled Two Wives. Now, that is not intended to be a put-down for you fine men who are members of the Al-Anon family group. Not at all. The fact of the matter is that when that book was published, there were no women sober in AA, so they entitled that chapter Two Wives. And the other chapter is entitled To the Family Afterwards. And down in my part of the country where I grew up in Al-Anon, we took a paragraph out of this chapter and made a preamble that we used for our preamble. This is what the paragraph says. The past is the principal asset of the alcoholic's family and possibly the only one. This painful past can be of infinite value to families still struggling with their problem. We feel that each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others how we were given help is the only thing that makes our life worthwhile. Cling to the thought that in God's hand, your dark past is the greatest possession you have. The key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death or misery for them. My good friends, that is heavy stuff. That is heavy stuff. That paragraph has kept me active in this program longer than some of you have been alive. That paragraph has made it possible for me to travel thousands of miles and to talk to many, many people. And I get sad, a little sad, when there's controversy about the book Alcoholics Anonymous, because I know the love and concern that those people who started this program had for their families. I believe with all my heart that of all the things an alcoholic loves, he loves his family most. And these dear people who put those chapters in that book for us were concerned about our welfare. And they knew that in time we would recognize the fact that we needed help. And that's why they made the provisions for us. And I've been extremely blessed in this program. I've been exposed to the spiritual giants of this program. The Al Badgers, the Horace Forts, the Bob Whites, the Chuck Chamberlains. And when I came to these people, I was absolutely scared to death. I found myself in the big middle of the state of Texas, 1,700 miles from my family. My Bill was one of 11 children. He had 5 brothers and 5 sisters. They didn't know what to do with me. They understood perfectly well why Bill drank too much, because he was married to that Yankee from North Carolina. So I spent a great deal of time teaching geography. I explained to them that North Carolina was south of Virginia. They seemed to understand that Virginia was a southern state. But I was absolutely scared to death. And I went to these dear people and I said, "I do not understand Bill. I just do not understand Bill. My Bill hates a liar worse than he hates a rattlesnake. But he can't tell the truth. And he's irresponsible. I can't depend on him. I don't know where he is half the time. I don't know when he's coming home. Or if he's coming home, I do not understand him." And these dear people handed me a book. Now please, please, please remember that I may not tell you the truth. This is my perception. And I don't remember the exact words that they used, but they said, "Here's a book. Read this book, Arbutus, and it will describe the nature of the illness that Bill has." And they went on to say, "And it will give you the spiritual tools that you need to restore your sanity." And dear God, that's what I wanted. I wanted a name. What is wrong with Bill? And I want every newcomer that comes into a group that I go to find out at their very first meeting that the nature of the illness is what causes the behavior. The nature of the illness causes the behavior that makes us so very unhappy and causes so much grief. It's not the alcoholic. You heard a nice young man talk this morning. He told you things that he had no control of. Once he took a drink, he never knew what was going to happen. And my Bill paid a large price to drinking. My Bill lost his left eye in a drunken accident before we were married. My Bill lost his left arm in a drunken accident. I was in a car with him. And he could not stop drinking. I watched this boy lose everything he had that he wanted to keep. I watched him lose the confidence of the people he worked for. I watched him lose the love and affection of his own brothers and sisters. And finally, I saw him lose his own self-respect. And I'll never forget the melancholy day when he was looked up at me, too sick physically and psychologically to hold a job. And he looked up at me and said, "Why don't you take the children and leave, Arbutus? I'm no damn good." I attended my first open AA meeting in Amarillo, Texas in 1948. And I didn't want to go to that meeting. I'm sure you've picked up on the accent by now. I'm a Texan by marriage, but I'm a hillbilly. I grew up in the hills of North Carolina, and hillbillies don't like to be obliged. Only reason I went to that meeting is because I'd put myself under an obligation to a very beautiful woman who was married to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. After we were seated in the meeting, a very beautiful woman that I later learned was a member of AA leaned across Marguerite and whispered to me. And what she said was, "How long has it been since you had a drink, honey?" And I wasn't embarrassed at the lady's question. I'm not a teetotaler. I used to say I didn't trust a teetotaler, but I have a little friend down in Wichita Falls, Texas, who's never even tasted liquor. She don't even know what it tastes like. She's a real teetotaler. And I would trust Mildred with my life, so I don't say that anymore. But Marguerite was embarrassed, and she answered the lady's question for me. For she said, "Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. I grew up in a house with two men, both of whom was my father. My dad was a two-fisted construction man who worked hard, he played hard, and he drank hard. Dad was a gray-eyed Irishman who taught me to love poetry, who taught me to sing Irish folk songs. He had the patience to teach me to work my geometry problems with his framing square. But on Saturday night, my dad turned into a devil. My father's alcoholism destroyed both of my parents. My father's alcoholism turned my beautiful mother into an old, ugly, bitter woman who hated him. My mother hated my dad as long as she lived. My mother hated Dad long after he was dead and in his grave. And the last years of her life, which she spent in total darkness, she hated anybody that had ever loved John Martin. And that included me. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. Now, I want you to know that when I brought our children to the state of Texas in 1944, I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my young husband's drinking. Not one single time had I ever heard that reference. Father Martin says the only way you can tell an alcoholic is by the one that you know. And my Bill didn't drink like my dad, and I was not concerned with his drinking. Dad was a hallucinating drunk who saw creeping, crawling things, and Mother never could understand when her jaw was broken that Dad had simply meant to kill a centipede that was crawling in her hair. She couldn't understand that. I'm quite sure I could not have either. But Bill was a life of the party drunk. He crashed debutante's parties and taught them to put you Littlefoot. But I watched this boy lose everything that he wanted to keep. And I wanted to help him. I wanted to help him. And I'm going to say something directly to you alcoholics. And please, again, don't misunderstand me. I would never want to say anything from this podium or any other podium that would hurt you. Dear God knows you've been hurt enough. But I've heard you stand at podiums like this and say, a non-alcoholic don't know what they're talking about. And I want you to know that I know what I'm talking about. I wanted to help Bill. With every fiber of my being, I wanted to help him. But I couldn't help him. I've held Bill in my arms through the long nights when he was in convulsions. I couldn't tell which one of those eyes was artificial. Scared to death that he wouldn't live till morning. And scared to death that if he did live, he wouldn't have any sanity left. I know what I'm talking about. I've worked with drunken women until my hair and my clothes reeked with the odor of alcohol. And gone home, grateful in the knowledge that but for the grace of God, somebody might be walking me up and down and feeding me black coffee to send my children to school. I know what I'm talking about. I think the feeling that I try to make you understand is the feeling that those of you who are parents will recognize. It's the feeling you have when you tend a sick child. The baby's burning up with fever and it cries. And you want to help the baby, but you can't help the baby because the baby can't tell you where it hurts. And we couldn't help the alcoholic because you couldn't tell us where you hurt. But please, please, remember what I said the next time you want to criticize a member of the Al-Anon family groups. We wanted to help you, but you wouldn't let us. You wouldn't let us. The drinking continued, and of course, as we all know, it's progressive. Bill started having personality clashes with the people he worked for, and he changed jobs pretty often. One of these jobs took us down to Knoxville, Tennessee, about the time they brought that atomic energy plant in. And I saw that sleepy little southern town turn into a madhouse. Thousands of people came in there. Bill had a good job. He was sales manager for Holland Furnace Company, had a good salary, got commission on all the furnaces that he sold, and he wasn't the least bit reluctant to take a little extra money on the table if you needed a furnace real bad. And we were evicted from a furnished house in Knoxville, Tennessee for non-payment of rent. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And I couldn't find a house in Knoxville because of the influx in population. had to go up into Kentucky 70 miles away to find a garage apartment. And I checked in with the hospital there and learned that I was not eligible to go there to be delivered of the child that I was carrying. We had two little girls by then, and Bill wanted a little boy, and we got Teresa instead, bless her heart. But I was expecting my baby any minute when I learned that I couldn't go there to be delivered of my child. About the time I got that wonderful news, they carried Bill home. Now, they'd carried Bill home before, but this time his leg was broken. They did agree to put a cast on his leg in the emergency room, and I was faced with the proposition of going home to mother. Mother lived in a very exclusive neighborhood in Cincinnati, Ohio, you know, the kind of places where they don't allow children. Now get the picture. Peggy was 3 years old. Nancy was two. Luther was almost a year old and couldn't walk. Luther was born with a birth defect that prevented him from walking till he was 3 years old. And I'm expecting another baby any minute. I don't know who was the most relieved when we got to Cincinnati, me or the bus driver. And we go out to Mother's house, and there's no elevator in the building, and Peggy and Nancy hold hands, and I balance Luther on my big belly. I looked like I have a watermelon that you just cut one slice off. And I balance Luther on my big belly, and I go up and knock on my mother's door. Mother was only 12 years older than my husband, and she hated him with a passion. After he got an AA, she thought she hatched him. I said, Mother, would you go downstairs and help Bill? And she said, and what is the matter with Bill? Is he drunk again? And I said, no, ma'am, his leg's broke. So she went down and helped him up the stairs and asked for one of those talks that you all know about. And she said to me, Arbus, you undoubtedly are the most brilliant child I have. But it takes a damn genius to get in a shape like this. And because of the volunteer work that she did, she was able to get me a bed in the Salvation Army Hospital. I'm not sure my friends in Texas appreciate that this part of my story. I'm not sure. I told Bill I was going to quit talking about it, and he said I should not because it's real good for you. How about them drunks? But I don't think those people, my friends in Texas, understand the shame and the humiliation that a hillbilly feels when they have to ask for charity. And I saw the look of pity and disgust on the faces of the people who served those eviction notices. And I saw the look of pity and disgust on the social worker's face when I finally had to go to a welfare agency to feed my children and get help for my young son. I saw the pity when she wrote on my application blank in bold black letters as if I couldn't read, "Husband is a drunkard." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. The drinking progressed, of course. It always does. When I brought the children to Texas in 1944, I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my young husband's drinking But when I came to Texas, we met some people. They called themselves AA members. And they could help Bill. And it wasn't because the people didn't want to help us. No, no. They'd have been happy to help us, but they didn't know what to do. No one knew what to do 50 years ago. But these dear people who call themselves AA members could help Bill, but they couldn't help me any more than I could help an alcoholic. And it seemed to me that they pushed me up to the edge of a precipice, and they didn't push me over, they just let me dangle there. But then, fortunately for us, we met some other people. Now, if I thought these AA people were weirdos, oh, my dear Lord, their wives were worse. Their eyes were dead. You know what I mean? Just nothing there. But when I came to these people, these non-alcoholic people who found it vitally necessary to work the recovery steps of AA to preserve their stability and to restore their sanity, I was absolutely and totally destitute in every area of my life. I had no faith in God. I couldn't trust people. Oh, I believed there was a God. I believe we had a creator, the universe, if you please, who changed the seasons. I thought he changed the days into night and hung up the stars to make it pretty for us, but I had absolutely no concept of a personal contact, of a conscious contact with God. Absolutely none. I know now, of course, that I tried to pray. And I know now that God heard me. I think that God listens very carefully to the prayers of the beginners and to the prayers of alcoholics, because he knows that we do not have the words that prayers are made of. And he knew why I couldn't trust people. People do not deal very kindly with families of alcoholics. And he heard me when all I could say was, "Oh God." I couldn't even trust myself. I was not responsible for the things that I said, and I was not responsible for the things that I did. And if there's an Al-Anon in this room that will look at me and tell me she never had an emotional blackout, I will suggest that she find another program. Some of these people seem to have been born with an understanding heart. And the rest of these people seem to have acquired that understanding because they had lived with a serious illness and sometimes with tragedy. And I knew these people. I didn't need a psychologist to explain. I knew these people. They could make my life a little bit better just because they were there. And they could teach me to live life one day at a time. And I used to say we didn't have a name, but we, dear Lord, we had lots of names. Some that I can't repeat in society, in polite society. But eventually, these weird people became known as the Al-Anon family groups. There's a little difference between AA people and Al-Anon people. Had you noticed that? Yeah, there's a little difference. There's no quitters in Al-Anon family groups. An alcoholic has to quit to get well, but there's no quitters in the Al-Anon family groups. We never quit hoping. Hurt burns low at times, but we never quit hoping that man we love will come home again. We know he's lost down the bottom of a bottle. We know that. But we never quit hoping that he'll come home again. And we don't quit helping the alcoholic. Dear Lord, we'll help you to death if you let us. But most of all, we don't quit loving the alcoholic. There's no quitters in the Al-Anon family groups. I don't know what happens to them, bless their heart, but they don't make it in Al-Anon. And I made friends in this strange little group. first right in that little group in Abilene, Texas. And then time went by, and I was elected delegate for the whole state of Texas. That's a pretty good piece of real estate, when you think about it. The only delegate Texas ever had, Al-Anon delegate. When I was elected, when my panel ended, they divided the state into two assembly areas. California divided their state, but they really needed another delegate, and Texas couldn't stand to be left behind, so they asked for one too, and they got me. I don't drive an automobile. I'm terribly dyslexic, and my dyslexia is directional, and the state of Texas won't give me a driver's license, and I don't have any respect for people who drive without licenses, so I don't drive an automobile. When I was elected delegate, I learned about this bus tour that the Greyhound people had, where you could travel 99 days for $99. So I put some money together and took that tour. And I made the districts in Texas. Bill took me out to El Paso, and I worked east. I was in a meeting every night and on a bus every day from the 16th day of October till the 19th day of November. I lost 10 pounds, but when I got through, the people, the Al-Anons in Texas, knew what World Service was all about. And that's when they divided the state into two assembly areas, and I never let them forget that it took two people to do the same work that I do. I always talk too long. When I sit down, I'll remember a lot of things I should have told you, and I'll remember quite a few that I wish I had not told you. We took those 12 steps and reared those four children of ours, and I believed at that point in my life that I believed with all my heart that because my children grew up in an AA environment, it would protect them from alcoholism. I would have staked my life on that. Bill was not there when Nancy was born. She was our number two daughter. Nancy came on Wednesday, and she met her father on Sunday. And as I say, they grew up. And I went around the country standing behind podiums like this, and I said, I'll put those four of mine up with any four in the world. And I would. Still would. Luther weighed into the Navy at 189 pounds, this little boy that wasn't supposed to walk. Weighed into the Navy at 189 pounds, came home on a minority. He went in a minority enlistment. He wasn't quite 18 years old. And when he came home, with the help of his dad, he started him a little business. Had 25 men older than he was working for him, and I stood at podiums like this and said, it's not bad for a drunk's kid. Our daughter Teresa, who was born in a charity ward of a Salvation Army hospital, graduated magna cum laude from the university. And I stood at the podiums like this and said, ain't bad for a drunk kid. To update you a little bit, Luther had 15 years sobriety when he died at age 52. He died of a diabetic heart. And it was a hard resentment for me to work through, because that boy never failed to get a physical. Any company he ever worked for, even when he worked for himself, he never failed to get a physical. And nobody tested my boy for diabetes. And by the time that he had his first heart attack and they did the angioplastic surgery, we took him to Houston to the world's foremost authority on heart ailments. Dr. DeBakey had turned his practice over to Dr. Cooley. And we took Luther to see Dr. Cooley. He had tears in his eyes when he said, "Mr. O'Neill, it breaks my heart to tell you this, but you're not eligible for a transplant because diabetic patients reject." I have a grandson that was sent to Korea a couple of weeks ago. He'd just been promoted to first lieutenant. And then called me when he got over there. And I'd looked at the weather station, and it said that Seoul, Korea had the biggest sandstorm that they'd had in 25 years the day that Cody arrived. And I called his mother, and I said they wanted Cody to feel at home because we had some pretty good dust storms in Texas. These kids grew up in an AA environment, as I said, did the things that they wanted to do, and did them well. Bill was a good man. He made us a good living. He educated our children. He didn't believe in education, but he quit calling college graduates educated idiots when our daughters got a few degrees. And my Bill loved me very much. I read in one of those Dear Abby columns one time when she said that the greatest gift that a man could give his children was to love their mother. And Bill O'Neill loved me. He was a good man. But those kids got mixed up with some other people's kids. And all hell broke loose. I started getting some late calls from the Austin area. My AA friends down there would call to say, "You can go to sleep now, Arbutus. We followed Luther and he turned in his own driveway." Then I'd get a call from the other side of Texas to tell me that Nancy slipped in the ladies' room at the country club and cut her eye pretty badly, and they had to take her to the hospital to get some stitches. "But she's going to be all right," they said. And to update my alcoholic prayer, as I said, Luther had 15 years sobriety when he died. Nancy's going to be 21 years sober in September. And I'm trying the best I can to learn to live by myself. Bill died in January, during the time of the Midwinter Conference over in Midland. And he was very fond of Nelda Rasier. So I called Nelda to tell her that Bill had gone to sleep and he never would wake up again. And when I tell you that I got bushel baskets of cards, I'm telling you the truth. I got cards from people whose name I did not recognize. People all over the world knew my Bill. He helped to start the tape libraries in Australia, New Zealand, Tasmania. And we sent tapes to military bases. 79 every month went out to military bases all over the world. And I wouldn't want Bill back, not with the pain that he had. No, no. Someone asked me not too long ago what I did before I met Bill. And I thought about it for a minute, and I went to school. I went to school and went to school. That's the reason you need a walking stick to get up and down your stairs. I went to school at Duke University and played basketball for them. Messed up my back. They didn't tell me that you got arthritis when you got turned 80. But you do. I'm going to quit talking. As I said, I never know when to quit. And I said that one time to Bill, and he said, "Well, honey, you just hush." I'm going to close the way I always do, and I want you to listen to me very carefully. The principles of this program of ours carries a message that the whole world needs to know. And you are the people that are most uniquely qualified to carry this message of any people on earth. I strongly suspect that within a stone's throw of this building, there's drunken men and women who will never know they're alcoholic, and they'll die drunk, as did Stephen Foster. And I strongly suspect that there's men and women within a stone's throw of this building who will not have the courage to face life one more day with an alcoholic. And they'll break up their homes if you fail to carry this message. And there's kids. This is Saturday, and Saturdays were always the worst time of all. These kids are afraid for their dad to come home tonight, or it could be their mother. And these kids will grow up with deformed personalities if you fail to carry this message. If you fail to carry this message, may God have mercy on these people. And may God have mercy on us.